The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo, fascicle, Continuous Practice, Part 3. Master Dogen taught, in the continuous practice of the way of Buddha ancestors, do not be concerned about whether you are a great or modest hermit, whether you're brilliant or dull. Just forsake name and gain forever, and don't be bound by the myriad conditions. Don't waste the passing time. Brush off the fire on top of your head. Do not wait for great enlightenment, as great enlightenment is the tea and rice of daily activity. Do not wish for beyond enlightenment, as beyond enlightenment is a jewel concealed in your hair. So as I've mentioned this week, we're concluding session for those of you who may have been joining us this morning. And during the week, I've given a couple talks on this fascicle, Continuous Practice, just drawing excerpts. It's quite a long fascicle, two sections actually, two separate fascicles, both Continuous Practice. And in this section, Dogen teaches in a way that's characteristic of a lot of Buddhist teachings, where it speaks in terms of what we should relinquish, what we should cut off, the practice, the kind of activity we should give up. To look at that more, just as with the precepts are presented as not killing, not stealing, not lying, and so forth, ceasing from harm. Looking at it, the affirmative side, which is implicit within the teachings always, is to profoundly trust in yourself, to live simply and free of attachments, to contemplate impermanence in this precious life, to live in the unity of practice and realization in this day, in this moment. That these are what Dogen is speaking about when he says to forsake name and gain, to not worry about whether you're brilliant or dull, and so on. How do we bring forth a life well lived as we're living it? To stand on the ground but not be afraid of the sky, to be at ease within this human body but not be bound by fixed ideas of the self, to step into, to embody our potential, our capacity as Buddhas, as enlightened beings, having Buddha nature. As a student of the way, this path of liberation is to, Dogen says, to not be concerned about whether you're a great or modest hermit, whether you're brilliant or dull. And of course, as practitioners, we can spend a great deal of time trying to figure out where we are on those spectrums of brilliance or dullness. And so we chanted this morning, do not judge by any standards. If you don't see it, it's just that you don't see it even as you're walking on it. When you walk the way, you see it's not near or far. We don't see it even though it's hidden. Dogen has been making this point in this fascicle. And that hiddenness is really, we can say that it's an expression of our delusion. In a sense, that is delusion, not seeing what's in front of us, not seeing things as they are, seeing things as hidden or dark when they're actually illuminated. We can also understand that as just a basic functioning of human consciousness. I remember in an introductory retreat years ago, somebody said, we were talking about delusion, and somebody said, you know, my grandmother's this wonderful, loving, caring, generous person. Is she deluded? And I said, probably. And she can be all of those things and be deluded, because deluded ultimately means it doesn't mean that we just run around wantonly creating harm. Fundamentally, although that can be an aspect of delusion, but fundamentally it means not seeing things clearly, clearly as they are. In the Surangama Sutra, which is sometimes translated as the Heroic March Sutra, an important sutra in the Mahayana tradition, Ananda is having a conversation with the Buddha. And the Buddha says, by day and night, beings ceaselessly come into being and perish. They always desire to continue to experience the world indefinitely through their faculties of perception. Their karma leads them to continually move from one place to another. Their thoughts and their karma become entangled with each other until they can't be seen apart. The Buddha says, this fundamental nature of your seeing, your hearing, your and all of your other awarenesses, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking, do not differ from one another. Their basic nature doesn't differ. But the six objects of your perception through each of those senses separates them so that your awareness is forced to become differentiated. Because our eyes see visual objects, because our ears hear sounds, and so on, he's saying that our senses demand that we differentiate this one nature that is undivided into separate modes of perception. Although the six sense consciousnesses share a single fundamental awareness, their functioning, the way they function, the way we perceive, the way they present the world to us, has become distinct. The consciousnesses and their objects are no longer in their correct relationship. The deluded mind has, in a sense, rendered that which is indivisible, whole, perfect, in its nature, and has rendered it as impure, as broken, as conflicted. The Buddha says, Ananda, now you wish to transform your visual, aural, tactile, and mental awareness, together with your other kinds of awareness, into the permanence, bliss, true self, and purity of Buddha nature. To accomplish this, you must pull out the root of death and rebirth and rely on your pure and perfect nature that neither comes into being nor ceases. Use this purity of your self-nature to dissolve the distinction between your original state of enlightenment and the illusory state of what comes into being and ceases to be. In other words, return to this correct relationship. And I think that's a very interesting passage and a very interesting way of presenting it, because in a sense, all of dukkha is the expression, the evidence of our suffering relationships, the ways we relate to everything. Because to have senses, to perceive the world, means that in every moment we are in relationship to something. We are perceiving something, we're understanding it, we're navigating with it, we're touching it with our senses, we are in dynamic relationship. And that when that is not a correct relationship, a relationship based in the nature of things, then it will necessarily and inevitably produce disharmony. We do see high and low. We see fast and slow. As a student, we can look around and see people of all different capacities. I spent lots of time, right, making myself rather unhappy, sitting in the zendo, contemplating all of the qualities that other people had that were better than mine. This one's smarter, this one's more eloquent, this one's more creative, this one's got a better relationship with my teacher, this one's, you know, whatever. Do not judge by any standards. But we do see those things, and there is truth in those things. And that's where I would get caught, because I would say, well, you know, but it's true. This person is very eloquent. This person is very bright. This person is, you know, and I would sort of do a sort of a rendering or reckoning of my own qualities. And it's like, you know, I'm okay. But I would see, yeah, there is high and low. There are people who are, you know, and that will always be true. It's always been true. There's some people who have the gift of the tongue. Some people who have developed a very highly developed capacity to move, to be creative, to be athletic, to be in sciences. I mean, there we pour our energies into all kinds of things, and those things get stronger. And so how do we reckon with those differences? How do we not be concerned with whether we're a great or a modest hermit, whether we're bright or dull? This is really important, and there are koans within the koan study that are directly related to this. One day a master was sitting before Taisho and pointed over to the blinds that were in which sunlight was pouring through, and two monastics jumped up and rolled the blinds up alike. And the master says, one has it and one has not. There for all the Sangha to see. Now, which is the one that has it? Right? And so that's where Dada Roshi used to often talk about building a cage. So the teacher in that moment builds a cage of high and low, builds a cage of bright and dull, and throws everybody into it. So that ultimately we can see through the illusion of that. And at the same time recognize there are differences. To not be concerned about whether you're a great or a modest hermit, bright or dull, just forsake name and gain, and don't be bound by myriad conditions. And so in those moments when I would be doing this, you know, comparative, competitive thing, you know, it's sooner or later, I would usually come back and say, wait a minute, is that why, did I come here to compete? Master Keizan said, sometimes you have to go back to your original intention. And when I asked myself that question, the answer was very immediate. It was like, no, that's not why I came here, and it wasn't. So how did I get off on this track that actually isn't my intention? Just forsake name and gain. Just practice this mind. Practice what appears in front of you. And so he says, don't waste the passing of time. Brush off the fire on top of your head. A very compelling image, right? You've got a fire on top of your head. Do you ask for advice? Right? Do you go Google it? What should I do? Oh, there are all of these different listings. Well, let me go through them. Read the reviews. Of course not. You put the damn fire out. Nothing else matters. In a sense, nothing else can happen. And so how do we brush off that fire in the midst of and along with everything? Dogen says it's called continuous practice. I remember years ago we did a whitewater retreat here in the Esopus with two fellows, wonderful guides who had expert canoeists and had canoed the Esopus many years ago. So they had kind of a distant memory of what it was. And what they, neither they nor we knew, was that the DEC had released the dam, the water from the dam. So on the day that we went out, the river was very high. There were standing waves in the Esopus. So we start off and things are well enough. And and we get down to what used to be the old bridge, which has now been was torn down years ago, but it was up. And there were pillars, as there are with bridges. And we were coming around this bend, and the river is moving. And we are moving. And there are people in two people in each canoe, and some of them are quite new. And as I was watching some of the canoeists ahead of us, I saw this. This is the paddle. Or this. The paddles are dry, are getting dry in the air. And the guides are on the shore screaming, power stroke, power stroke. What they were really saying is, get the damn paddle in the water. You have to paddle now. Implicit in that is, this current is strong and it will take you in the direction that it is going. And that direction is into the rocks. If you don't put your paddle in the water and paddle to brush the fire off your head, you're going into the rocks. It's quite a moment. Nature's like that. Brings things home. Master Dogen said, if you want to attain the matter of suchness, you must be a person of suchness. You already are a person of suchness, so why worry about the matter? Don't be concerned whether you're a great student of the way or a modest student of the way. What does that mean? Well, when we assess ourselves, we know what it means, whether we're conscious of it or not. We never judge ourselves without a standard of measurement. It doesn't make sense to judge without some sense of what the basis for judgment is. And we have created, generally, that basis of judgment. And oftentimes, typically, it's just based in whatever our own current ideas are about what we think we're doing, what we think this is supposed to be about, which are very often incomplete, to put it generously. And so how do we practice that faith in Buddha nature arises from deep within? Master Dogen Zwi Monki said, without exception, everyone is a vessel of Buddha Dharma. Never think you are not. And for those of you who might have just gone numb at those words, because you think he is not talking to you, without exception, everyone is a vessel of Buddha Dharma. Never think you are not. If you practice according to the teaching, you'll see this for yourself. Because of the laws of causation. If you practice according to the teachings, that is important. That is essential. Then you will see this for yourself. And then to offer some evidence, he says, since you have a mind, you can distinguish between good and evil. You have hands and feet, so you lack nothing to be able to practice gassho or walking. The postures, the practices of a Buddha, do not be concerned with whether you're capable or not. Now, as I said yesterday, why is he saying these words in the 13th century? Someone needed to hear them. Someone did not believe these words. How difficult it can be for us to have deep faith. We have enough faith to have brought ourselves here. But that may be enough faith to just want to explore Zazen or meditation or to seek out a community, all of which are good. But not enough faith to imagine that we ourselves are just such a person. And as a pointer, Dogen says, just forsake name and gain forever and don't be bound by myriad conditions. We are always in the presence of myriad conditions, your body and mind, your consciousness, how it functions, and the conditions of our lives, our time, our place, because all of that is influencing us. But he says, don't be bound by them. And name and gain are two of the, what's called the eight worldly concerns, happiness and suffering, fame and insignificance, praise and blame, and gain and loss. Just ways of talking about those extremes, right? As I was talking about the rotten tomatoes and the encores.
Bravo!
You fool. And when we're at the bottom looking up, or on the outside looking in, which is generally where we place ourselves, when we're within those eight worldly concerns, there is pain and confusion. And it's natural, because we've been taught to, think that, well, if I only get to the top, when I get to the top, or when I get inside, then just wait. Just watch me then. Right? Did you ever play that game when you were a kid? We called it King of the Hill. Right? It's like, I was just thinking about that this morning, it's like a perfect preparation for white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal, domination, civilization, right? There's a hill, doesn't matter how big or small it is. Somebody gets to the top, and then everybody else tries to tear them down. And so you get to the top because you've torn somebody else down, but look around, here they come. And just a moment ago, you were one of them. So even if you get to the top, now what? Mercy, mercy. But all the while, dukkha is not inherent in happiness, is not inherent in suffering, it's not inherent in success or failure, in having or not having. The characteristics that each of us have, some we may think that they're, we were born to them, we may have developed them, usually they're both. Other attributes that are not that developed, because maybe we haven't developed them. We all devote our time to different things. That's not a problem. It's when we impute, from a Buddhist perspective, when we impute inherency, intrinsicness into qualities, then there's nothing you can do about it because it's a fixed thing. And so you are dull or you are brilliant. I was coming across a teaching by Kenjin Throngku Rinpoche, Tibetan master, who was talking about the kleshas. And the kleshas are referred to as karmic obstructions or afflictive emotions. They're the underlying basis sort of stuff of the results of our karma that exist deep within our consciousness that are the basis of these eight worldly concerns, the basis of all of our suffering. And they're basically the root of what generates our karma. And so when something happens, somebody says something, and we react, we have a reaction, we have an emotion. That emotion is the result of that sort of karmic making, kleshas. And that the kleshas are completely intertwined with words and language and meaning. And that's why the relationship in Zazen and practice to our thinking mind and our conceptual making mind is so important. It's not just about calming the mind, that when the mind becomes more calm, the kleshas become more calm. Everything becomes more calm. Our capacity to see becomes brighter and more clear. And so the teacher says, when we realize that the kleshas are empty, that the emotions that arise, the karma, the actions and the results of those karma, of those actions, the agent of those actions and the recipient, that all aspects are empty of any intrinsic existence. Nothing exists on its own. Everything is a creation. He says, when we see that they're empty, we were very fortunate. Because he says, if kleshas really did exist, if they were true and solid, then the effort to abandon them would be insurmountable. And in fact, essentially, we wouldn't be able to. Because their nature would already be set, fixed. There would be little we could do about them other than avoid, right? Or make alliance. He says, but once you see that they're empty, once you see that they're empty of intrinsic value, they will gradually disappear. And he goes on to say, I say gradually, because simply seeing the emptiness of one particular klesha on one occasion does not prevent the reoccurrence of kleshas. And this is very important, right? Because oftentimes we, you know, particularly in the literature, we hear about somebody has realization, they're enlightened, and we think, okay, that's like an absolute moment. That's an absolute shift, an absolute change. And in one sense, it is, but it's not absolute in its embodiment, in its integration. He says, when you practice the tranquility meditation, he calls it the concentration meditation, right, where you're just focusing on the breath and calming the mind. He says, one of the effects of this is that your kleshas are weakened. But as you'll see that aside from weakening them, the practice of that concentration meditation doesn't eradicate them. But when you practice insight meditation, when you see into their real nature, then you actually see that they don't exist. Through seeing the non-existence of a klesha, it is conquered. It is pacified. And that particular klesha at that moment is pacified and conquered, but that does not prevent a reoccurrence. And that's an essential thing to understand. In that moment, there is liberation that is true and real and is all over the body. But that moment, because nothing is permanent, does not prevent a reoccurrence, because the underlying dispositions, the underlying seat of the kleshas is still there. The reason why simply seeing the emptiness of a klesha once doesn't prevent its reoccurrence is that we have a strong habit of entertaining our kleshas. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have parties all the time. Some are laughing parties, some are crying parties. It's my party and I can cry if I want to. Some of you may be too young to remember that song. He said, there will be fluctuations in your experience, which means that sometimes you'll have a heightened awareness of the emptiness of the klesha. It's direct, it's immediate. It pervades the body. There's a sense of, this will always be so. I will never forget this. And it will be easy to observe the emptiness directly. And sometimes your awareness of emptiness will seem somehow dull or diminished. It will not serve to enable you to see the true nature of that klesha. As long as the habit of indulging kleshas has not been eradicated, there will continue to be the need actually to observe their true nature over and over again. That's why Dogen is speaking of continuous practice. That's why we train throughout our lives. That's why great masters of Buddha Dharma continued to practice, sometimes even more so. Because then they were able to see so clearly the importance of continuing. When we don't see, it's easy to not see why it's so important. It says, although someone who has seen dharmata, which is the nature of reality, has directly experienced the nature of mind, this insight must be further cultivated. He says, if you don't continue to cultivate your practice, then it will be abandoned and it will have less and less effect over time. So there's continuing. He says, there's an analogy, he said, our bad habits are like the tendency of a scroll that has been kept rolled up to roll itself back up, right? Every time you try to unroll it, right? You roll it out, you let go, you unroll it. It seems to have a force of its own. It's a nice analogy. And so I think this is really, really essential. And it's, you know, I mean, it's, this is spoken about all the time. But to because again, the teachings, you know, it's like the koans, there's a student, there's a question, there's an answer, and the student has an insight or is enlightened. And from the way it's presented, it's over. Right? That's the end of the story. Right? But of course, it's not. In a way, it's just a new beginning. It's a new beginning now with that insight. That's why it's a new beginning. And then it has to happen again and again. I mean, why are there hundreds of koans? Right? Why, once you've had an insight, once you've seen into your self nature, isn't that enough? And why has that always been true, that it is not enough? Why is it that we continue to practice? And then in a very real sense, it does become more important, because that fledgling, if you will, like a fledgling in a nest, you know, the feathers are damp and they're not fully formed, right? And the bird is, the little chick is just starting to fly, and everything's awkward. And they have great power, but they're not fully in it yet. And so sometimes they jump out of the nest, or the parent kicks them out and they just drop to the ground, right? Or they flutter a little bit. They're not yet ready to fully fly, although they're fully bird. And so the continuation, the continuous practice, we see, is essential. And that's, you know, one of the disappointments of practice. It's like, hey, wait a minute, I thought if I have this insight, if I see into self-nature, and that's confirmed by my teacher, that then aren't I enlightened? No, actually. To realize the absolute is not yet enlightenment. So at what point do you become enlightened? Is that the correct question? At what point are you enlightening? That's a question you can work with. Dogen says, even when you are uncertain, do not use this one day wastefully. It's like a rare treasure to value. Don't compare it with an enormous jewel. Don't compare it with a dragon's bright pearl. In other words, don't compare it. Old sages have valued this one day more than their own bodies. Reflect on this quietly. You may find a dragon's pearl. You may acquire an enormous jewel. But this one day out of 100 years can never be retrieved once it passes. It's gone. What skillful means can retrieve a day that has passed? None. No historical documents have recorded any such means. Not to waste time is to contain the passage of days and months within your skin bag without leaking. I was talking yesterday, I think, about, was it? Yes, but I don't know to whom. Sorry. It might have been in here. It might have been somewhere else. But I was talking about how over time, in time, each day, we're accumulating wisdom. We're accumulating experience. In a sense, we're accumulating the jewel of zazen, of practice, of study, of calming, of remembering, of returning, of faith. And we draw upon that. We draw upon that all the time. And that's why he's saying, don't get hung up with the size of the jewel, the brightness of the pearl. It is vast and boundless. It is radiant beyond measure. Don't worry about it. Getting hung up about it doesn't make it larger or brighter. It does put it at a distance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. I imagine since the beginning of time, or at some point, this became fairly common knowledge. Something that everybody knew. And discovering it once then assembled different strategies about what to do next. Bury it. Conquer it. Find a way to live forever. Live forever in something. Build a monument. Clinging to life, existence, only brings heartache. And so how to bring forth this great urgency to recognize the preciousness of this human life, the great fortune of having encountered this Dharma and being a practitioner without grasping, without becoming righteous in our mind. Dogen says, once you have clarity, and having entered, we have enough to begin. Do not neglect a single day. Wholeheartedly practice for the sake of the way and speak for the sake of the way. And we can hear that as just a kind of relentless sort of sweatshop, right? You're sort of at the wheel of practice every day. Oh my God, sweating it out, putting in the time, no breaks. Get back to there. What are you doing taking a break? Is that the evidence we see in the chronicles of our ancestors? We do see wholehearted practice, and we do see periods of great effort, yes. Sometimes that are extremely humbling. But what else do we see? Do we see the before and after? Do we see what else there is? So in our resting, in our laughing, in our enjoyment, in our suffering, in our sitting, in our walking, that's what Dogen is talking about. That's why he says, don't wait for great enlightenment. Enlightenment is the tea and rice of daily activity. It's not something that's up ahead. Because our nature is enlightened already from the beginning. Nothing you can do about that. To change your enlightened nature, nothing you can do about that. But there's everything we can do with the knowledge of that, with the hunger for that. And so Dogen says, reflect on this every day. Wake up and think, I'm alive today. That's what you know. That's about as far as it goes. Today I'm alive. I have this life. I have this day. I have this mind. And I have this day before me. How will I use it? And so he says, reflect on this every day. Sit near a bright window and reflect on this, on mellow and flower-filled days. Sit in a plain building and remember it on a solitary rainy evening. Why do the moments of time steal your endeavor? Why do we let them do so? And so he's saying, at all moments, at all odd and unexpected moments, bring forward just a moment of reflection. Remember. And in that moment of reflection, as you're reflecting on your life, reflect on those of others too. Those who inspire us. Those who may be much less, in a much less advantageous position. To have that moment of contemplation because of their myriad conditions. Contemplate your part in that. Our mutuality. What does it mean to live on a path of awakening, of inquiry? It means pretty much that, to inquire, to reflect. And Dogen says it so beautifully. He says, if you want to climb, when you climb to the top of an iron mountain, okay, sit there for a moment and reflect. When you're walking along the edge of a razor, okay, stand there for a moment and reflect. But you can also do it sitting next to a bright window on a mellow and flower-filled day. You can do it on a rainy evening in a plain and drab building. Why do the moments of time steal your endeavor? They not only steal one day, but they'll steal the merit of many kalpas. What kind of enemy is the passage of time anyway? Why do we see it that way? Why does it become that? You know, I've always so appreciated and respected the kind of in-your-face quality of the Dharma. Right? Let's just say it. Let's just meet it. It's so much easier. From a distance, it seems like it will be too hard. But what helped me in many such moments was to stop from that place of distance and look around and say, wait a minute, this is hard. And this is harder in a whole different kind of way because I'm at a distance. When I come closer, maybe it'll be difficult. But that's a different kind of difficulty because I'm closer. And so, this refrain that I've been bringing forth from this fascicle, this continuous practice is bound to be sustained by continuous practice. It confirms itself. Every day we practice confirms practice and prepares us for the next day. Love and respect your body, your mind, and self that are engaged in this continuous practice. Appreciate that. Think of the third immeasurable, sympathetic joy. To delight, to rejoice, to be gladdened in your heart at the accomplishments of others, the good qualities of others, the good fortune of others, and of yourself, your body, your mind, yourself that has brought you here. He says, love and respect that. That is really the laboratory in which we learn how to bring that to everyone. There's nothing really abstract about it. And so again, let's let Dogen have the last word, the poem. The true person is not anyone in particular, but like the deep blue color of the limitless sky, it is everyone, everywhere in this world.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.